This is an ABC podcast. On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
My co-host for The Conversation Hour today is Corey Perkin, who has a bookshop, which she very subtly named after herself. Good morning to you, Corey.
Thank you. I've dropped the my bookshop by Corey Perkin. You know how that came about, don't you?
No.
Well, when I first opened the shop, I was a journalist. So you used
for
to seeing
many,
you know,
many years
you
were
used
a
to
journalist.
Seeing, you know, 10 Dead in Car Accident by Corey Perkin sort of thing. So I thought I'd have a play on that. But then I realised, as we were getting the bookshop ready, which is actually 10 years ago right now. I remember on grand final day I was unpacking about $20,000 worth of books from Penguin. So, and we opened in October 2009.
Oh, mazel tov.
Thanks very much. I know we're still here. But
well, 10 years, you've defied the odds, I might say, because both small business and particularly bookshops have a notoriously short lifespan.
And let's not talk about the recession, but John, we don't mention the R word.
We don't have a recession.
Oh, that's right, we don't. Not in retail.
You're in recession-proof, well-to-do, well-heeled part of Melbourne.
Oh, don't be so ridiculous. There's no such thing as well-heeled part of Melbourne.
I drove through it the other day. I was roadblocked by the imported luxury four-wheel drives.
Well, let me tell you about Hawkesburn, where our shop is, John.
Oh,
It's on the border of, you know, Prahran, South Yarra, Windsor, East St Kilda. Lots of our customers are from East St Kilda.
And
you
Toorak.
Know, No, Toorak people don't come to the bookshop.
By golly!
No, they have their own bookshop in their own suburb.
Oh, they come for the supermarket and that very
a lot of
fancy
the families,
Kitchenware
oh,
shop.
A lot of the families
the
in our area are struggling.
The hand curated shop that sells strawberries individually presented and
this is so north of
polished.
The era of you, John. This is such a stereotypical.
I have to drive
view.
Through it to get to my parents. When
anyway,
I go
let me tell you
week,
why
I've
named
times.
I named the bookshop.
Yeah,
as I was unpacking
name?
This, yes. there was a book that popped out of one of the boxes, which was I can't even remember the name of it. But it was an American woman who had built her own business and she wrote about it.
Yep.
And I thought, you know what? I am going to call this My Bookshop by Corey Perkin because in a few years' time I'm going to write a book about the shop experience and I'm going to call it My Bookshop by Corey Perkin.
Have you been keeping a diary?
Yeah, I have. But I have since dropped, not an official diary, but lots of emails go into and notes go into a folder on my computer because I think one day I'll write this nonfiction book about what not to do. But
what not to do?
But I have dropped the Corey Perkin from the bookshop name because it's a bit.
What makes it harder to sell when you get sick of it?
Good point.
Unless
hadn't
you can find
that.
Someone called Corey Perkin to buy it.
I was thinking more, you know, like humility reasons, but yeah, that's probably another. I'm not going to sell it. I love what I do.
Was someone called Mr. Readings in charge of Readings? Was, you know, Woolworths wasn't the Woolworths family, was it?
Weren't they the Waltons?
And Coles was the Coles family.
They were.
Wasn't it?
Meyer was Meyer.
Oh, it certainly was.
Anyway, so, John, that's it. 10 years we celebrate. But last night we celebrated something else at the bookshop, not our 10th birthday because that party's coming up. But last night at the bookshop we celebrated 100th. Yeah, I didn't invite you.
No, you didn't.
100 episodes of the podcast I do with Caroline Wilson.
Oh, congratulations.
100 episodes.
Because podcasts are.
It's almost like you're 25 years.
30, thank you very much. Well, the age got it wrong today.
How dare they?
How dare they? I've been working here for
30
years.
Gosh, that's unusual.
23 on this shift, they said. I've been 23 years at the ABC. I've been 30 years at the ABC.
No, but John, I remember when
I was
at home with the little babies who now are in their 30s. And I would listen to you with Ramona talking about your law. You had the law report, I think.
Correct.
And you'd go on Ramona once a week to talk about legal matters, which was one of my favourite segments.
Was it? Thank you. I started in 1989 to do the law report, 89, 90, 91, 92.
God, you were only 17.
And then they swapped Ramona to Radio National and they put me on 3LO. It was called the Great Jew Swap of 89, 90, 91, 92, 93. The Great Jew Swap of 93, where Ramona was sent to Radio National and I was swapped from Radio National back to 3LO. I did a year of 10 till 12 and then I did a year of afternoons. Then I got sacked.
And then you came back.
And then I went to the Investigators.
That's right. I remember that.
That was hilarious. Did a year of television. And then I did another year of a show called Wise Up on TV, which was like Q&A with teenagers.
Don't remember that one.
No one does. except the people whose lives were somewhat shortened by working on it. No. In fact, it was good fun. I shouldn't say that. It was good fun. And, yeah, then I was resurrected.
So I'm going to...
'97.
I've swung a deal with the lovely producer John here
that
I can come back on before you officially leave.
What, so even in the next month?
I'm coming on in another couple of weeks.
Oh, okay.
So I don't want to ask you the nostalgic questions.
No, we're not doing that. It's going to get tedious if we do that every day.
Exactly right, but you have been giving me...
So tell me about your podcast.
Well, this is actually a nice segue from your career into this podcast thing. Look, the podcast is called Don't Shoot the Messenger, and, you know, I'll leave it up to everybody else if they want to go and download it or have a listen or subscribe or whatever. That's up to them. But Caroline Wilson, award-winning journalist in Melbourne, everyone knows her.
And all-round fabulous person.
Yeah. Yes. She and I walk a couple of times a week, mm-hmm. and one day we were walking with two of our youngest daughters, and we were just talking the usual stuff that we talk. Footy, films, what did we cook the night before, bit of royal gossip about the royal family. And the two girls were sort of in fits. I don't know whether they thought it was, you know, just so boring. They were mind-numbingly boring, or they thought we were actually genuinely quite funny. And they said, you should consider doing a podcast like Annabelle Crabbe and Lee Sales. Oh, yeah, ha, ha, ha. Well, anyway, a few months later, we were offered an opportunity through Croc Media to use their studio, and Craig Hutchinson came up with the name, actually, Don't Shoot the Messenger.
Is he selling tickets for it?
So Carol and I...
At inflated prices?
Stop it. John, behave. So every week we get together and we just chat about what we talk about when we go on our walk. And people say, well, do you get nervous beforehand? No, I'm talking to Caro. It's easy. And, you know, we finish a show and we just go, but we haven't talked about this, we haven't talked about that. We need an agenda.
You want an overflow. How many subscribers do you have?
Well, actually, funny you should say that, because I just did write this down. We have over 20,000 downloads a month. Mm-hmm. And we have several thousand subscribers, but that is, they're doing new testing on this at the moment, so I'll have an exact figure hopefully by the next time I see you.
Right.
But we've had nearly 500,000 downloads since the show began.
Yeah, but it might be the same people doing it over and over and over again.
Well, my family members.
There was a Dorothy Readings.
There was, yeah.
Who started up the bookshop, claims Alison, who says she went to uni with it.
And Mark Rubo bought the business from Dorothy. Yeah. Isn't that a great surname for a bookshop?
It is. It was meant to be.
But, John, what I was going to say to you about this...
podcasts?
And radio. Last night, one of the visitors to the shop, who has been listening to us almost since we started the podcast, said to me in a quiet moment after we'd recorded, she loves listening to us because she's home alone quite a lot and she feels like she has a couple of buddies there, and she never feels alone when she turns on the radio. She did mention ABC.
Good.
Or a couple of podcasts she listens to. And I said, I know exactly how you feel because when I was a young mother, at first at home, which was a shock after all those years of working, and you're at home with a baby, you feel so alone and isolated. And it was you, Ramona, Doug Aiton, Mary Adams, who sort of got me through the day, the week, the month, the year.
And I get, at the moment in particular, I always have got letters from people along those lines, but at the moment I'm getting emails and handwritten cards and letters from people saying that. And I got one, I think it's all right. I'm a man who works in northern Victoria in a very physical environment. I'm being careful here because I don't know that he wanted all of his details broadcast, so I'm disguising it all.
Do you mean kind of building industry?
He works in a very physical industry, and he said, I work with a whole bunch of people who I never really had that much in common with, but it was good work and all I could get in this part of Victoria. And I used to walk around with headphones on and listening to you, and then I went back and did some study, and I've worked now in management, and I'm sure that part of the reason why is because listening to the radio and you and other people's programs has meant that my mind has been much more open than if I was just listening to music all the time. It's inspired me to go back, get a better education instead of dropping out of school, and getting a much better career and a life out of it. And I can't thank you enough. And I actually teared up as I read his message and then replied to him this morning.
I can see little tears here right now, John Fain.
It is really hard.
Some people call you a hard ass, but yeah. I can see little tears.
Yeah, just a pussycat.
But John, this is, I mean, it's kind of like my work here is done. Like, if there's nothing else that you, you know, if it's nothing...
It's never done, and that's the role of the... I mean, I'm really insistent on this. That is the role of the organisation, and the rostered morning announcer, as I'm known, the rostered morning announcer is playing that role. We're all just tiny little links in this long and incredible chain. And that's what radio, uniquely what radio has done and still does and will always continue
to do. And will
always
do. And, John, the thing is,
because you can't work dangerous machinery whilst you're studying a screen and reading, flicking through websites. And it's audio, and that's where it's so powerful.
And but the retention as well when we listen is so, I mean, tests have shown that.
While you're driving a car, while you're fighting a bushfire, or while you're fleeing a bushfire.
People often say to me, because they know that I occasionally come on and I'm here on ABC and I've been part of the ABC family for a long, long, long time.
You're part of our extended family on this show, yes.
But Doug Asia, before you, and like I feel like I've been here since I was, you know, toddler. But anyway, I have been around these studios a while, and people do know that, and they know now that I have the podcast, and they often say, do you think podcasts are robbing the ABC of the audience? And I go, absolutely not. It's training a new generation to listen. And what a lot of people say to me is they download the ABC app and they download programs such as yours.
How do you do that?
Oh, thanks, John. And Late Night Live, so people can actually become their own editors and listen
show,
to their favourite people.
Things. That's right.
So I think actually the two can work so conveniently well together.
The original Woolworth Five and Dime stores were founded in the States by Frank Woolworth.
Oh,
says
gosh,
Terry.
Did I say Walton? Sorry, I made an
error.
Sorry, Terry.
That's all right. The audience know everything. That's
they
the
do.
Other thing. They absolutely do. Corrie, thank you for your kind words. Corrie's got a podcast with Caroline Wilson. Don't Shoot the Messenger is the title of their podcast. You can find it where you get your favourite podcasts. And yes, don't forget, you can shop around, you can listen as you want to and when you want to, how you want to ABC radio programs, wherever you are, including the text I got this morning from somebody who is in Portugal on holiday and said, I'm listening to you over here in Portugal.
John, can I just say one quick thing? About the football, the tragedy of Danny Frawley that's happened this week. I don't know whether anybody follows or subscribes to Fox Footy, but if they can get their hands on Jared Waitley's beautiful interview last night with Danny's two great friends and colleagues, Jason Dunstall and Gary Lyon, the two blokes have been off air all week because they have been shattered.
Yep.
And Jared did... You know, a friend of yours and mine did such a great interview. So if anybody can kind of find that on their Google or whatever, it's really
and that's
worth
what people do now. They curate their own listening, and that's a wonderful thing. Corrie Perkin is my co-host. Our first guest is Vicky Petritis. She's written a book about writing books because there's so much interest and fascination in what she does as a true crime author that she's probably got sick of explaining it all and thought she'd write it all down. And then she can say to people, oh, it's all in the book, just go and get it. Vicky, good morning to you.
Good morning, John.
Welcome back to The Conversation
Hour. Thank you.
You've been here a number of times, going back how far?
It's 26 years now.
Just the other day.
I've done lots of radio promoting this new book.
I think you just told me that the first interview you ever did
was with this guy called John Fain, and
welcome to the real world of media. Was he nice to you, Vicky?
No. Well, I was so nervous because I'm a teacher, and I got into crime writing because I wanted to write, and crime writing just stole my heart. And so I had absolutely no training, no idea whatsoever on
quote,
how
to... page 48, I nervously asked Melbourne radio interviewer John Fain what he was going to ask me. He snapped back that I would find out when we were on air. He's lucky I didn't faint. Was I horrible to you?
Yes.
Could you do it in that snappy voice? Say that again.
I apologise.
Thanks, John.
I apologise to you and to all the other people
I've been horrible to. You should snap back and say, you'll find out when we start.
Yeah.
Take that, debutante.
I'm kind of like, oh, my God, oh, my God. So I think all of these first, and then my first TV was Bert Newton. And, again, I didn't know how to do it. They left me in the green room. They announced
they forgot
I was
to get
on
you
after
down
the
on
break.
Set. They didn't like
and then
you
they
up.
Raced me upstairs and someone shoved a microphone into my belt and said, don't worry, only 5 million people are watching. So just this baptism of fire I had to navigate because I was a teacher, and that doesn't exist in the world of teaching.
No, didn't put you off, and you've had how many
no.
books out now?
14.
14.
Yeah. You lose count
15,
after a while.
Whatever it might be. And it's become, I mean, you got in pretty early on what's now regarded as one of the most, do we call it bankable, sellable, one of the most in-demand genres.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm using that word a lot in the last few days, which is true crime. So what's the appeal of it to you?
The appeal to me was always about resilience. It was about people. It was about finding out why people did what they did. But it became more about how people survived and thrived. What was the difference? So, like you, I've spent 25 years listening to people's stories and listening to heartbreak and listening to people turn something awful into something positive. And it becomes more about humanity. That really, for me, is what true crime is about. And at its best, it can change a law or it can bring about public awareness. And that's pretty cool.
I love in your introduction, Vicky, you say you're talking about true crime helps people confront reality. Perhaps true crime is compelling because we want to know how people survive it or how we might survive it if it happened to us.
Yeah.
I must say that when I read a crime novel or a true crime book, I am there. Imagine if that happened to me. The Frankston murders in the early 1990s that you refer to in the book, the victims were around about my age.
Yeah.
I knew that area quite well. And all I could do was put myself there. How many times has a woman like myself left the train station after hours or whizzed up the street to get some milk and walked home without even thinking about our own safety? And there, of course, lies the opportunistic murderer. And it's so hard to not feel those things and that pain and wonder how are we going to kind of get through this. Is this why people read true crime and fiction?
Yeah, I think it is.
Because they imagine themselves there.
I'm doing a PhD at the moment and looking at story theory, and one theorist talks about we don't read story to escape reality, we read story to navigate reality. And MRI evidence, as people are reading, has concluded that we don't read as observers, we read as participants. And I think for so many women, they come up to me and they say, ever since I read the Frankston murders, I always check the backseat of my car before I hop in. And things that, so women are reading these things on two levels. One is for the story of the people and how they survived, but the other is almost a safety manual. If that ever happened to me, this is what I would do. And so I think we do it for our own safety. That's why it's so popular, I think, with women.
Do you read it as well as write it?
I read it less and less now. I read a lot of crime fiction is now my preferred reading.
The title of your book, Inside the Law, 25 Years of True Crime Writing, you've actually put yourself at the centre of this story.
I know, it's a bit nerve-wracking, actually.
How easy or difficult is that after all these years of writing about everybody else?
I think when I was doing, I do now lots and lots of public speaking. So since you mentioned podcasts before, and since the advent of the True Crime podcast, I've gone from being a nerdy writer who writes about that weird true crime thing to being, oh, my God, I've heard your podcast. It's like I've been writing for a quarter of a century, but I do a dozen podcasts and all of a sudden my name is out there so that's everything sort of changed. And I think the more talking I did, the more public talks I did, the more it's like, well, here's what happened in the Frankston case, but I was in the back of a police car at one of the crime scenes. So people are like, oh, how did that happen? And how did you feel? And so it started to become more about me. But as you know, with writers, we're not in the story. And some writers are, but I never was. And so this time I went, okay, just took a deep breath and said, people are finding my story and my learning and my wisdom inherently important.
Policing is at the moment under more scrutiny than it's ever been in this city, in this state, and for, I must say, very good reason.
Yeah.
Are you somewhat disillusioned, distressed, or upset about what's being revealed almost every day at the Royal Commission? Because you're very close to lots of police. You've worked so closely with them for so long.
Yeah. I think lots of other scandals that we've ever had in this country have always been grassroots, on the ground kind of dodgy cops. But I think what's striking about this is that it's the top down and we're all watching with great interest. One of the things that struck me, I wrote a book on the dog squad and I interviewed handlers.
You mean the actual proper dog squad?
The actual dog squad.
Not the nickname.
Yeah, the actual the furry
wolf
ones.
Wolf, John, wolf.
When I say furry ones, I'm surveillance people might be furry as well. I'm not making no comment. But
and in making no comment, you just did.
Whoops. One of the handlers said to me that they were wanting GPS satellite locators because often they would chase bad guys over fences and then they would find them, but they wouldn't know where they were. And one guy was describing how he'd caught a gunman and he's grappling with the gunman, trying to radio, "We've got him." And he commanded the dog to bark, and the police going up and down the streets had to wind their windows down and listen to him for the dog barking. But for the expense of these locators that would cost $200 or $300 per officer. And at the same time, the police were offering Carl Williams nearly $2 million in cash and prizes for a statement against Paul Dale. And so just as a human and as someone who says, hold on, if the police out there on the street aren't getting, and they ended up, because I think I was writing the book, and they ended up getting those locators, which was great, but I would hate to think of police at the coalface missing out on things that are really life-saving, potentially.
Sure, but you're also... You wrote a book with Paul Dale,
yes,
did you not?
Yes, yes.
Who is a person of intense interest in this whole underworld war.
Yeah. And why I wrote that book, if you read my book, you'll understand my life is nuts. I work full-time as a teacher.
Yeah,
I'm
who's
doing
looking
a PhD.
After the kids today?
I'm... Pardon?
Who's looking after the kids today? What's happening to grade
know.
Three?
I left them in a room locked up, no. Because I had surgery on my foot, I have this weird and very rare 5-week period of recovery, and I limped in here on crutches. But
you have too. Yeah.
So I do have a window, a blessed window.
Back to Paul Dale.
But when Paul Dale... So my life is crazy and I don't have time to read newspapers and I just have time to fit in what I do. And so when a friend of Paul Dale's approached me and said, Paul Dale wants someone to write his book, I'd never heard of him. Does that sound bad?
No.
I don't get out much. And so I Googled him and I went, whoa, okay, sure. I'd never written about gangland. I'd avoided it because to me it's guys that want to make lots of money and shoot people. And if you watch Underbelly, boobs, that's it. And that to me was never of any kind of interest. What I am interested in is cases like the Frankston murders or pedophilia, how people target children so parents can protect them. So gangland was never my interest. So I had to do a really crash course on who's related to who and who's friends and who's connected and who was mortal enemies. And I met with Paul, and what really impressed me about Paul is that he came to my house with a ute full of files and he said, I'm not going to say anything. You just read them and you let me know what you think. And so the minute I started to read, I'm like, oh, my God, this is bizarre. It was just bizarre right from the start. They, because he'd been charged with a bunch of things, he had then discovery. So he had all of the...
copies of all the documents.
Copies of everything. Okay. So Lawyer X expense sheets of $310,000 of 32 flights and limousines and just anyone reading it has to go, this is wrong. This is crazy. So this is going back to, I think, 2012 that I was uncovering all of this. So it was an important story. Not Paul was at the epicenter of it, but the way the Australian Crime Commission behaved, the way that the police behaved.
So if people are wondering who Paul Dale is a former Victoria police officer who has at various times been accused in coronial inquests and other trials of being corrupt, of being a crim, and being, in fact, in some times...
A murderer.
The architect of the murder of police informers and the shadowy behind-the-scenes figure who is one of the architects of Melbourne's underworld wars.
And he used to say if he was old enough, they would have put him on the grassy knoll.
He's never been convicted of any of those crimes, although he still stands in many people's minds as a man under intense scrutiny.
Until they read the book. So people that read the book have just said to me and to him, oh, my God, I can't believe this happened to you. And the way that he was treated, I think we rely on our system to be fair and we rely on it to serve everyone. And if you read what happened to him, it's flabbergasting. It's crazy.
Vicky, not only this particular Royal Commission and all of the investigating into VicPol at the moment that's going on, but you've also over the years written about cases that have subsequently become Royal Commissions, and I'm thinking in particular your earlier work on abuse of children within the Catholic Church. Can you tell us a bit about that chapter in the book?
Yeah, I wrote a book called Rock Spider. I was ringing around police units and asking cops for their best story. And I don't, as a full-time teacher, I can't go to trials and I can't do what other writers are able to do. So I kind of work in reverse and say, what's your best story? And you know how cops just have this crazy life. So if a story to them is their best, that means that it's super crazy or super big. And I ended up talking to Chris O'Connor, who was at the time the head of the Child Exploitation Squad. And I think we had one conversation and I said to him at the end, this needs to be a book. He was telling me stuff that I needed to know as a parent and as a teacher and that I didn't know. And so I spent this horrifyingly emotional year at the squad, going in after work at night. So I'd sort of go in and whoever was on in the afternoon or night shift, and I would be in my little room with files and videotaped interviews with pedophiles and looking at pornography and just being horrified that this existed.
And you saw this link with the Catholic Church coming through?
Well, I was working as a Catholic primary teacher then, and I must say that for me to understand what was happening in the organisation, because I wrote about Ridsdale and I wrote about Pell, but here's the weird convergence that I've had in my life is that Pell was coming to our school, the school where I worked, to do the confirmation of the kids. And we did not like him. He was really arrogant. And I would often describe him as he was so lovely to the kids, but the minute the bell rang and the kids went out and we'd say, oh, Bishop, could you sign the certificates or whatever, he'd snap at us and he was so rude. And now, of course, in hindsight, in after his recent conviction, that's now a little bit creepy.
Vicky, congratulations on all of those books and the ones still to come. This one is a book about writing books, about why Vicky Petritis has become a true crime writer. Inside the Law, 25 Years of True Crime, and she goes through some of those stories that she's told before, but this time putting them into a completely new context, which is the chase of the story itself. We're all joined by the comedian-musician who is the first and probably only person in history to lick every Australian state and federal parliamentary building.
Mm-hmm.
But why?
Why?
Well, why not? You haven't lived until you've done it. This is it's a true story. John, he's got his eyebrow cocked, of course, permanently. It was Adelaide Fringe Festival a few years ago. I was there performing and I was strolling past. And, you know, these days in the age of social media, we need content all the time, don't we? You have to put things online and make sure people know you're still there. Mm. So I took a stupid photo and said, oh, look, this is me licking South Australian Parliament. I'm starting a new project. It's called The Taste of Democracy, and I'm going to lick every building. I thought I'd leave it there, but then...
So how much of it do you lick?
No, just one quick little lick. Just exactly like that.
Right.
And never do that again, John. Listeners, you're grateful to not have seen that image.
On the granite?
On the granite. They've got large columns outside South Australia, there on North Terrace. Anyway, and then people started believing me, and so I'm nothing if not a man of my word. So I was doing a touring throughout the year, and every time I went to a new capital, I started just taking a little photo or a little video and licking the next building. And then people started being smartasses and saying, what about Northern Territory? You know, I went to Darwin, I licked that one. I licked the Australian Capital Territory Legislative Assembly.
As well as the Federal Parliament?
And, of course, finished at the Federal Parliament.
Which bit of it did you lick there?
The flagpole. And there's
how did you get to the flagpole?
Well, I went up in the lift. You can get there.
I thought the grassy knoll, I didn't think you were allowed up there.
No, there's still a lift in the centre of the building that takes you up for the views. Ah. This is even despite the presence of the fence and so on. And it was probably the highlight of my career. I got Barry Cassidy, no less, to narrate a documentary, which people can Google. It's called The Taste of Democracy. It's the best 3 minutes of comedy you will ever see.
Hey, Sammy, I guess every building in Australia is built from different materials. Mm. So you'd have bluestone in Melbourne, sandstone in Sydney. I imagine there's a different taste to every building.
You're absolutely right, Corrie. I think...
I'm so perceptive, John.
Tasmania. Tasmania was, without a doubt, the best. It was that convict sandstone, you know, windswept, that Antarctic breeze.
Bit salty.
Oh, a little bit salty, but Melbourne was the worst, undoubtedly. Yeah. Smog, trams, you know, probably reflective of those inside the building, wouldn't
Which
you say, John?
Did you lick there?
Melbourne was one of the quicker ones because every now and then a security guard would catch my eye. Brisbane, I came as close as I've ever been to getting arrested as I sauntered up with my phone in hand. I was doing a live stream for Facebook, as the kids do, and hadn't got permission or anything, and security guard came and tried to stop me, but I said, I just need to lick this, please.
As a crime writer, I want to know what the charge sheet would read, you know, for unlawful licking of...
I'm not sure. Is it, would it be trespass or tongue trespass? I'm
not vandalism, sure. I suspect.
Well, can I write the book if you do
please,
get arrested?
Please. It would
thanks.
Boost my profile immensely.
Sedition, wouldn't it?
Well, I think sedition was in Western Australia.
Vandalism, because you're salivaring.
Treason.
Treason.
In Western Australia, I actually applied Vegemite. As someone had suggested, I need to make it more Australian, so I put Vegemite. And rather horrifically, it was a proper stain. Like, I tried to wipe it off afterwards, but it had soaked in. And then someone else helpfully pointed out I'd licked the back end of the building. I actually licked the arse of the Western Australian Parliament, which was my own punishment.
What goes on inside your head?
Very little, John. That's why I end up doing these sorts of things.
It does make you what I did on the holidays conversations much more interesting, doesn't it?
I had a choice probably 10 years ago with my pathetic little career as to whether I would go mainstream and be adored by the masses or just do what I find funny. And I've consistently just done that. And
I think you've always got to please yourself, Sammy. Don't worry about the masses.
Absolutely.
But tell us about that. What is what is behind the new CD that we were just listening to before?
Indeed, and thank you for saying CD, Corey, because the CD itself of this album, it's a beautiful product. We've had lovely designers, there's a sheet of music inside it, but of course these days anyone under the age of 24 has never heard of a CD, let alone knows how to open a case. So it's mainly available for streaming and download as well. But it's called Symphony in J Minor. It's my latest batch of songs, but there's a little bit more to it. There's music and there's cello. This guitar, it's, I guess, trying to step up a little more musically.
It was recorded live.
Mm.
Does that enhance the performance for you?
It's to the detriment of the performance, undoubtedly, because I can't do it again. You know, you're left with what you recorded, but it's to the benefit of the spirit, John, because there's an audience there laughing at the jokes.
So there's more energy from the audience, isn't
Absolutely.
There?
And it's one of these things, like with so many things in life, it's more about the general energy and the vibe than being perfect at every moment. Probably incorrectly with books, Vicky, you get to edit and write and perfect the paragraphs more so, and that's important in that process. But for me, I'd rather that the vibe of a live performance was reflected than necessarily getting every correct note on the keyboard.
Do you prefer a live performance? I saw you, I don't know, how many years ago at Queenscliff Music Festival?
Oh,
you
yes.
were doing a session.
Nothing stops your flow on stage, John, than looking out and seeing broadcaster John Fain critiquing your every word.
Laughing at your jokes.
No, you were laughing, thank you. Yeah. Appreciate that.
Well, I was just in the
crowd. He was working out whether you could ever do a good back announcement.
I know, and then he set me up today. How dare you? No, just go back to this moment, John. Only 12 minutes ago, I'm still horrified. You tried to outsource your job. No. You haven't left the ABC yet. You've still got a job to do, and yet, Sammy, you do your own back announce.
Take it as an audition. you should kiss the Blarney Stone, says Christian Fernie Creek. My four-year-old was licking every seat in the cafe we were at yesterday. Ah, dear. But you're not short of material in this increasingly confusing world that we're in.
No, I'm actually in a bit of trouble this morning. The only reason I've turned up here, John, is because I'm hiding from the ABC editorial staff.
And the lawyers?
And the lawyers, because last night I do a weekly sketch. It goes to air just before the news every Thursday, and last night I did a sketch called The Parliamentary Piss Taker, which involved me playing a role of someone in Canberra whose job it is to drug test politicians. But it was rather graphic. I'm there taking the urine samples and indeed in one part of the scene sniffing the urine samples to identify which politician the sample came from.
Mm-hmm.
So we had, for example, you know, one that was a little flat and not resonating, that was Anthony Albanese. One that was a little weak and spelt like spinach, that was Di Natale. And one that had shades of potato and thwarted ambition, and that was Peter Dutton. However, on arrival this morning to the building, I've learnt that not every viewer in Australia was so keen to see this played out as they ate their dinner.
So you got a few complaints, did you?
I'm yet to count the tally, but yes, I think there'll be words.
Do you get a breakdown of the complaints according to state of origin?
Oh, I could request it, although I'm generally just ask them to either tell me whether I've been axed or not, and if I haven't, I'll keep on going.
What do you think, John, would be the answer?
Well, there was a time some years ago, and I won't be thanked by various managers around here for telling this story, but there was a time some years ago where, you know, when we go on holidays at Christmas and someone stays back up till Christmas and does a national program, and I was asked and I agreed to stay on through December and do a national program. If I remember correctly, it was December. And apparently there were listeners in, maybe we should just say, some more northern parts of the continent, who found the sort of program that was unremarkable for other parts of the country, they found it was just a little confronting for them.
A little risque, John?
No, not risque. It was just they weren't used to having someone like that on their ABC.
I see. Well... Yeah.
And in fact, there was national talk back, and I do remember there was one woman from Queensland who called in to talk about the illegals, and she was concerned about boats. I think it was at the time a boat crashed on the rocks at Christmas Island, and I think either then or it was at the inquest or it somehow it was relevant. And when I corrected her and said there's nothing illegal about seeking asylum under international law, it's entirely people's rights, that provoked a sack full of correspondence from listeners in Queensland who wanted to just, first of all, insist that the ABC sack the person who said that and correct the record, because obviously these people are illegals, because that's what our politicians have taught us, and they didn't understand how that could possibly be regarded as acceptable.
Well, it's fair to say you certainly can't please everyone. Can you, John, in that instance?
Well, no, you can't. But if you're doing things that are funny and people are reacting, I would have thought that's something that we want rather than something we shy away from.
Well, absolutely. And I'm sure, well, perhaps or hopefully we'd all agree it's fine for people to criticise you so long as it's not abusive. And in fact, it's lovely to engage with people who have something to say about your work or your books or your presentations. But
there's nothing worse than if you did your three-minute piece on a Thursday and nobody reacted. That, to me, would be far worse than if lots of people react. And if their reaction is, that was going a bit far, that means they are thinking about what is, how far can you go? And that's a good thing.
Absolutely. And in the case of political satire, it's so often the case that people get very upset about a joke you've made rather than getting upset about the subject that you're dealing with, which is far more horrific in most cases than an individual making a joke about it.
Do you think Australians are particularly good at satire, political satire, and combining it with music? I'm going back to the days of the Gillies Report, for example,
yes.
When they used to do the wonderful stand-up sing-alongs with Bob Hawke, Max Gillies' Bob Hawke and so on.
Absolutely. I think it's been a huge tradition in Australia. And even now in these tumultuous times that we live in, I often just remark that, you know, when you look at what's happening, for example, in Hong Kong, or pick any country around the world that is not necessarily, going through a stable moment, here I am as one example of someone who's being paid by the government to go on television and make fun of the government, and that is
take the piss.
And that's much as I have fun and it's all lighthearted, it's a very precious thing for a democracy to be able to, you know, have that within their ambit.
And as long as you're making fun of everybody, you're not just constantly targeting one party or another, then that's all anyone can ask for.
That's the best complaints I get are when I'm accused of being either a Liberal Party stooge or a Labor Party stooge, because it happens both ways, and that's when I think, well, I'm doing something right then.
Yeah.
Sammy, do you have a pin-up in this particular area, either locally or even internationally, you know, going back to, I suppose, Dudley...
Peter Cook and Dudley Moore?
Yeah, Peter Cook, thank you.
As far as someone who I would take inspiration from, probably goes all the way back to Tom Lehrer, who wrote political satire songs in the 1960s, and whom I modelled my early schoolyard compositions on.
So Pigeons in the Park.
Poisoning Pigeons in the Park. All my early songs were written in response to Tom Lehrer's songs. So he wrote The Elements, which was putting every single scientific element into a Kilvin Sullivan song. I wrote the entire Melbourne train network, which dated horrifically because the bloody government's kept adding stations, and then I mucked up all my rhymes, so I can't sing that anymore. But Tom Lehrer would be a huge inspiration for me, absolutely.
And quite rightly too, because he was a remarkable, remarkable man.
He is a remarkable man.
Is he still alive?
Yeah, he spread rumours that he died, but he spread them himself. A Harvard professor in mathematics.
Oh, an extraordinary...
I think you should revisit your Melbourne Railway Line song.
I can give you Frankston Line. I think that's changed. Frankston, Cannanook, Seaford, Carrum, Bond, Beach, Chelsea, Edith Vale, Aspendale, Morty, Alicant, Parkdale, Mentone, Cheltenham, Hyme, Raven, Patterson, Mentley, Ambekinnon, Horman, Glen Huntly, Malvern. I've derailed.
They
were building a Skyrail and I fell right off.
I think we got Southland, didn't
Yes,
we?
Southland, exactly. So, yeah. No, can't do it. And also, I found that song didn't travel interstate very well.
Who would have thought?
Should work on the national electorate song.
And indeed, you have a national tour coming up with this new concert of the performing the new, I was going to say CD again, the new downloadable set of songs. What do you call them?
I call them CD because it is, as Sammy said, it is actually in CD format. I saw that.
Yeah.
What do you call it, an album?
Notes. Well, I call it an album, but I, as I said to Corey, I think CDs are precious things.
They
you
are.
Know, and it's.
And you can open yours up and pull out the paper.
Absolutely.
I got it turns into a paper plane.
Oh, oof. And so
a map of the trainways of
yes.
But are there is there political humour that plays differently as you tour around as well?
Absolutely. Perhaps one of the best known sketches that I performed this year on ABC was called a song called Goodbye Queensland, which was an ironic look at the south side of Australia breaking up with Queensland in the wake of the election results. And the national tour that I just completed recently finished up in Queensland itself. singing that song to 700 Queenslanders. Thankfully,
at the Powerhouse in Brisbane, 20th of July. That would have, 19th and 20th. Yeah,
yes,
right.
Two nights. Yeah. So, yes, it was some
fun
to
did they sing along joyfully or did they throw scones at you?
No, I amended...
Pumpkin scones.
I amended the lyrics. I changed it to Far North Queensland just for the two Queensland before. So everyone in Brisbane felt very smug and righteous because it wasn't aimed at them at all.
Okay, dare you to go to Cairns.
Yeah, well, if you build it, I will come.
Okay. They've probably got a venue there, haven't they?
Oh, they've got a beautiful venue.
Yes, and they'd have state or federal buildings there that Sammy can lick.
Yeah, town halls. That's the next thing.
Town halls, yeah, municipal level.
Yeah, it'd be too hard.
I was thinking international. I want to lick the White House. That can't go wrong, can it? Just jump the fence, get in there.
Yeah, I wouldn't try to that Westminster just at the moment either.
No. Yes, it's a bit of a bitter taste going on in
You've done a Brexit song? I mean, that's just lending itself to ridicule.
Well, I did a Brexit yoga routine earlier this year on telly, which was the most popular sketch I've done. It's 6 million views online, but most of them...
Hey, what?
6 million views, John.
So that went global?
It went global, but that's the pathetic thing, that it's all in Europe. So I'm massive in Frankfurt right now, but these people aren't coming to my shows. I need to relocate.
6 million?
Yes. It was... I've never been in that position of having a proper little viral
So what
hit.
Was the premise of your gag?
Well, I was just doing a yoga routine. It's one of my characters that I do on telly, so talking people through different routines. And this was the Brexit yoga. So, you know, we were uniting our kingdoms and then we were getting into our Theresa May poison chalice position. And then we were backing away slowly. And then we were desperately begging for a better outcome from the European Union. Lots of fun moves to play along. But it was the first time I've had friends from... England saying, hey, they're playing you on telly over here. You should. I'm like, it's too late. I tried to crack a UK 10 years ago.
Did you put online ads on at least so that you got 2.5 cents every view or something?
John, the ABC does not advertise, and you know that.
Oh, was this an ABC thing?
Well, they own it. Eventually, it all leads back to ITA.
Oh, okay. You could put it onto YouTube or something at least.
Yeah, no, it's all there on YouTube, but okay. Publicly funded.
Oh, well, excellent, excellent. So, look, I don't know. I haven't heard anything around the traps. There hasn't been an email that's come through saying, could everybody please just make no further mention of Sammy J? That has happened from time to time in the organisation when there's been something disgraceful that has happened.
There was an email that got sent around 2 days ago when I was filming the piss take sketch saying Sammy J will be filming in the toilets on level 3. And so suddenly everyone in the building, I don't know many people in the building.
They rushed to the toilets.
Yeah, yeah. And then I feel like everyone's blaming me because I didn't know the processes, the bureaucracy in this building. I thought I could just sneak in with a camera. But no, you've got to do it properly.
Well, I think that's probably worth a screenshot for Twitter. look, congratulations. The album, including a CD, is downloadable and out now. There's been a national tour. Have you got any other gigs coming up that people need to be preparing for?
Prepare yourself for Thursday night just before the new sketch each week, and I'll try and make it more grotesque next week than I did this week.
Well, and if you... I mean, look, if you're going to go out, you go out with a bang, has been my approach.
And Frankfurt's waiting for you too, Sammy.
Yeah.
I'll be there in a heartbeat.
Don't worry, there's always Frankfurt. Sammy J, the new album is called Symphony in J Minor. Vicky Petratus' book, Inside the Law, which tells how she got into and why she kept going with the world of true crime writing that she's so much made her own here. And Corey Perkin, who has a bookshop called My Bookshop, not by Corey Perkin anymore, is my co-host on The Conversation Hour today.
On ABC Radio, this is The Conversation Hour.